When Ralph Martire was David Inge's guest on Focus a few years ago, he said Illinois could climb out of its big budget hole if state officials would take his advice. That was in 2009. Today, in 2013, Illinois still has a budget deficit and all that comes with it, despite some severe spending cuts and a state income tax increase. And Ralph Martire says state leaders still haven't taken his advice. Ralph heads the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, which has argued for years that Illinois' budget deficit is built into its tax policy, and balancing the budget requires changes in the tax code, such as a progressive state income tax. The CTBA is officially nonpartisan, but it doesn't win many points with conservatives for stances like that one. But maybe Ralph Martire can change some minds. I'm Jim Meadows, and you can join the conversation with him on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There's sort of a bet going on between the Illinois General Assembly and Standard & Poor's. Currently, state lawmakers are trying to hash out a pension reform bill, but Standard & Poor's has lowered its bond rating from the state to A-. They did that back in January, predicting that substantial pension reform either won't pass this year or will be bogged down in legal challenges. Well, pension reform is just one part of the state of Illinois' budget problems, but it's an important part, and it's one of the things we'll be talking about today with Ralph Martire. He's executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability in Chicago. He's taught classes on fiscal policy at the University of Illinois and Roosevelt University. Ralph Martire also serves on the U.S. Department of Education's Equity and Excellence Commission. When he was last on Focus, Ralph was in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk, and he'll be back again in Champaign-Urbana this Thursday night. He'll be speaking at 7 p.m. at the main Champaign Public Library this Thursday in a talk presented by the Champaign County League of Women Voters. His subject, the fiscal crisis in Illinois, a solution. So, Ralph Martire, welcome back to Focus. And I'm sorry, we seem to have lost Ralph Martire. We did have him on the phone just a few minutes ago, and we're going to try to reestablish contact with him as we talk about the state budget and the state pension reform efforts in Springfield. We'll be welcoming you to the conversation as well. If you have questions or comments about the state budget, our pension systems for Ralph Martire, call us and tell us about it at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Ralph Martire, I hope you're back with us on Focus.
Well, I think so. I mean, I have been known to annoy people with the stances we've taken, and maybe, I already annoyed your whole audience and got me clicked off the phone.
Well, I hope we have you back for the hour.
I think so, yes.
Welcome back to the show, Ralph. Last time you were on Focus when David Inge was the host was, I believe, in November 2009 when Rob Blagojevich was only an accused felon, not a convicted one. Have things changed much with the state budget since then?
Really, two key things have happened. The dollar amounts have changed, but the core problems remain the same. And I think the one sort of saving grace that's happened in the intervening years has been that temporary tax increase. If you look since that temporary tax increase passed in 2011, the state's budget deficit has pretty much stabilized at between 9 and about $9.7 billion a year, which is huge, by the way. It's a 35-37% deficit in general fund spending. But until that temporary tax increase, the budget deficit amount had been increasing by a few billion a year and literally was going to be approaching $18 billion but for the revenue raised by that temporary tax increase. So now we're stabilized at a $9 billion deficit, which is not a good place to be stable, but at least it's not getting significantly worse.
So there's been an increase in the state income tax. It's good till, I guess, about 2014 or 2015?
2015 is when it starts phasing down. And so we went from 3-5% on the personal rate and from 4.8% to 7% on the corporate income tax rate. And those were both temporary tax increases. And by the year 2016, they both phased down. the personal rate is going to decline from 5% to 3.75%.
Unless lawmakers do something.
Unless lawmakers do something about it. And really, they need to. They need to maintain at a minimum that revenue, because if they don't, the year-to-year revenue decline, if you were to compare what we'd have in revenue in 2014 before the phase-out and 2016 after the phase-out, it'd be a $3.5 billion difference. And the state just can't give away $3.5 billion right now, given that the debt service it owes to its pension system is based on an amortization schedule or a repayment schedule, whatever phrase you want to use, that is increasing significantly from year to year. And that's really the problem, and none of which has been dealt with, by the way, by any of this legislation that's been proposed.
Now there are folks who have argued that what you really need to do is cut spending.
Yeah, and they're just wrong.
Okay.
I appreciate that argument. And, in fact, it's not just folks. I mean, when Southern Illinois did a wonderful poll of the state of Illinois just about a year and a half ago, and it said, hey, voters and taxpayers, what should the state do to solve its fiscal problem? Should it cut spending or should it raise taxes? And not surprisingly, about 58% of the state said cut spending, right? That's the way to solve the problem. But higher percentages across the board, 68% don't cut education funding, 66% don't cut health or human services funding, and about 63% don't cut public services funding. Well, guess what? Over $9 out of $10 the state spends through its general fund goes to education, health care, human services, and public safety. So there's a complete disconnect between the voters' preferred approach to solving the problem, which is, of course, cut spending, don't tax more, and their desire to not see any of these core services cut. And you can't cut spending without focusing on those four core service areas, because that's $9 out of $10 spent.
There have been cuts made. There's been cuts to Medicaid. There have been prisons closed. So I assume there is some less money being spent in some areas now in the state.
Well, actually, across the board, we are spending less on every category of public service today than we did in the year 2000 under Governor Ryan. And I think that would open a lot of eyes. In fact, if you go all the way back to 1995 and you adjust for inflation, we're spending less on education, health, and social services and public safety today than we did under Governor Edgar. So Illinois has been implementing very significant cuts to these core service areas. Public education in Illinois is so poorly funded. We could spend your whole hour on that, but I just want to give you some numbers. So we're about to cut education funding, and this is just the K-12 budget, by $400 million roughly year to year between fiscal year 2013 and what's proposed for 2014. Well, that would be disastrous. Right now, our funding level for K-12 is well over $4 billion less than what it would cost, based on independent analysis, to purchase an education of sufficient quality to get 2/3 of our non-at-risk children passing the state's tests. So our education funding overall in Illinois is woefully inadequate if our goal is purchasing an education that could actually provide children with the numeracy and literacy skills they need to succeed academically. And isn't that sort of the goal of an education system? So we're already $4 billion below that amount, and we're cutting education expenditures. We have the fifth largest population and fifth largest economy of any state, just to give you some context, and we rank 41st or 42nd in per capita expenditures on public education. I mean, we so lag the rest of the nation and our own standard on purchasing a quality education that it's embarrassing. And yet, we're cutting it now, and we're cutting it by significant amounts, close to $1 billion, actually, in cuts after inflation since the year 2000 alone. So that's a major step away from investing in one of those things that everyone knows drives economic growth long-term, attracts high-end employers, and provides kids with the skills they're going to need to be competitive in a modern economy. So this is really bad public policy, and that's just one aspect of our cuts right now. So what Illinois needs to do is grow up and recognize that what it has historically had is a revenue problem, not a spending problem. We've always ranked in the bottom 40 of all states in total expenditures on core services, despite having the fifth largest population. We've come nowhere near meeting need. We've always ranked in the bottom 10 of all states in overall total state and local tax burden as a percentage of income. So that includes every tax and every fee charged by any unit of state or local government against people. In Illinois, we still ranked in the bottom 10 in the country compared to Indiana, whatever, all these other states. So we've been low tax and low spending, nowhere near meeting needs, and yet every year our revenue growth isn't sufficient to maintain services after inflation. So every year there's a little deficit growth. This is a structural deficit in the cost of maintaining services from year to year and the revenue generated to maintain those services. And so what we've done in Illinois for decades is try to paper over this structural imbalance between revenue growth and service cost growth by engaging in highly irresponsible practice of borrowing against what was owed to the pension system. So we took that borrowed money, and instead of putting it into the pension system like we should have, we used it to subsidize service delivery costs. This revenue problem was first identified in the early 80s by the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and pretty conservative economists like Jim Nolan, who's a Republican who ran actually for lieutenant governor with Ogilvie back in the day, and Fred Geertz, who's a moderate Republican economist and stuff. And it has never been addressed. So we've always had a revenue problem, and we've tried to paper over it first with borrowing against the pensions and now with dramatic spending cuts. But none of these things will ultimately solve that structural problem until we fix tax policy to work in a modern economy. It's time to grow up and do that.
Well, when you say fix tax policy, I think you're getting to the proposal for a graduated income tax, progressive income tax here in Illinois, instead of the flat tax that it currently is.
Yeah, no, well, there's a couple things. You know, I'm tired. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty tired of dodging magic silver bullets. And there is no one that can fix a state that has the significant size of a problem that Illinois has. Our problems are deep and structural. So there's actually three things Illinois needs to do if it's going to ultimately get its fiscal house in order. Number one is what you just said. We need to get a constitutional amendment that will allow implementation of a graduated rate structure for the income tax. And what that means, because this is really poorly understood by a lot of people, it doesn't mean taxes gradually get higher over time or anything like that. It just means that different levels of income are taxed at different rates based on ability to pay. So the higher your income, the higher the tax rate will be that applies to that income. So say, for example, somebody earns $100,000 a year. On a flat rate structure like Illinois currently has, you pay 5% on all that income. In a graduated rate structure, what could happen is on the first $50,000, you only pay 2.5%. And then on the next $50,000, you pay 5%. So overall, your tax burden is less, even though the tax structure itself has become graduated because the rates adjust. And we've actually had the opportunity to run what a graduated rate structure could look like for the state of Illinois through the Illinois Department of Revenue's dynamic modeling system. And so what that allowed us to do was get a real handle on the impact on people and on tax policy that going to such a structure could have for our state, and it's really positive. It uses, because in the Illinois Department of Revenue system, it uses the actual tax returns filed by Illinois residents. So this is real data. It's nothing modeled out or made up or anything like that. There's no assumptions. It's just what people really report as their income. But because it's a dynamic system, it takes into account tax avoidance strategies. So when you go to a graduated rate structure, you say people earning $1 million on their income that's $1 million or above, they're going to pay, let's say, 10% just on that increment. They will engage in some tax avoidance strategies, which is rational behavior, right? Anyone would. And so it takes all that into account. And what we found was if you went to a graduated rate structure, you could literally cut the income taxes paid by 94% of the state of Illinois. That's 94%. This is people reporting taxable income of up to $150,000 a year or less. So that's taxable income. That's not your gross income. This is what's left after you've taken out your deductions.
Okay, so you're saying 94% of Illinois taxpayers would see
tax relief.
Okay, now I just wanted to note, and I don't know where they get their figures, the Illinois branch of Americans for Prosperity, in a recent, as in Friday, fundraising letter, claims that a progressive income tax would actually raise taxes on 85% of Illinois taxpayers.
Yeah, I don't know what they're talking about either, and you're going to have to ask them about their data. I mean, ours was run through the Illinois Department of Revenue's modeling system and peer-reviewed by two independent PhD economists at the University of Illinois.
Well, let me go.
I'm pretty comfortable that our numbers are accurate.
Okay.
And to go beyond that, so only 6% of the state would feel the impact of the income tax increase, number one. And number two, what would happen is, of that 6%, no one would see their overall effective tax rate go up by more than like 2% of income a year because of the tax avoidance strategies available to them, even though the marginal rates would be much greater than that. So we'd cut taxes for 94% of the state. We wouldn't create significant tax burden for upper-end earners, and we'd raise $2.5 billion more in revenue than current flat tax system. Now, why does it work that way? And I think you need some of the underlying data for that. What you have to understand is the vast majority of income growth in America since 1980 has gone to the wealthiest 10%. This isn't class warfare. This is Internal Revenue Code data. So from 1980 through 2007, once again, using Internal Revenue Code data, so this is actual reports that people make of their own income to the federal government, 63% of all income growth in America went to just the top 10% of income earners, meaning that just about 36.5% is what was left for the bottom 90%. So if you don't have a graduated rate structure, number one, you can't tax people fairly because ability to pay right now is very much skewed in favor of people at the top end of the income ladder, and that's not evil or immoral, that's just what the data say it is. And so, to be fair, you want to focus your taxes up there where folks are paying taxes out of their growing wealth, and hence it doesn't really cut into their disposable income or their lifestyle habits, et cetera, as opposed to focusing taxes on low and moderate income working families who have, especially after you factor in inflation, flat to declining incomes over time. So literally, tax burden at the bottom and middle does cut into ability to provide for the family, put food on the table, et cetera. And this principle of fiscal policy, of tax policy, isn't something that the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability stumbled upon or made up or is our own theory. It actually is a core component of capitalist tax policy, and it goes all the way back to a guy named Adam Smith, and I'm sure you know who Adam is. He invented capitalism in the Wealth of Nations in the 1770s.
Let me, Ralph, ask you to address another pretty familiar argument from groups, including Americans for Prosperity, that what the state needs to do to bring more tax revenue in is actually change laws and tax structures and policies to make the state more business friendly. In Americans for Prosperity's copy, create an environment where success and entrepreneurship are encouraged and rewarded. And this is supposedly things that, according to, say, the governor of Texas and Florida and other states, say that Illinois is not doing.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful rhetoric, because how do you disprove it? Seriously, there's nothing in there that's data-based. It's all rhetorical arguments. You're not business-friendly. It's kind of like the confidence genie. I prefer to make public policy analysis using empirical data, best practices, and putting the two together and saying, what do the data tell us? What do best practices tell us? And shouldn't that be how we chart out our course of policy? So let me take on Texas and Florida, et cetera. You know, their economies are a little different than Illinois'. Texas has the whole oil industry, and Florida has the entire entertainment and vacation industry, correct? So to compare those states to our state, which is a classic Midwestern industrialized state that had a heavy reliance on manufacturing up until about 1980, and then from 1980 forward saw its industry shift to more of a service sector provided industry, is just disingenuous. They're completely apples to oranges comparisons. What is, I think, more illuminating is looking at the economic performance of different states from a tax policy basis, because one of the arguments frequently made by Americans for Prosperity and groups like that, which are unabashedly, and they say this themselves, ideologically focused in their approach to policy suggestions. They have a worldview. Their worldview is if you just got off the back of business, everything would be good. And that's what they pursue alone. So here's what the data say. This was an analysis done by the Institute for Tax and Economic Policy. There are 41 states in America that have a state income tax. 9 states do not. What they did, the Institute for Tax and Economic Policy, was compared economic growth using 3 key factors: unemployment rate, change in median wage, and growth in state GDP per capita. So overall economic growth, wage growth, and unemployment rates, the 3 biggies. Over the 10-year sequence, 2000 to 2010, and they compared the 9 states in America that have the highest individual income tax rates in their graduated rate structure, so the highest income tax states, to the 9 states in America that have absolutely no state income tax, which includes Texas, by the way, and Florida. And based on these 3 factors, what they found was the 9 states with the highest marginal income tax rates had greater growth in state GDP per capita over the sequence than did the non-tax states. They had a better change in median wage, and they had identical unemployment rates, which completely disproves this canard that state tax policy, if it's high or if it even exists in this case, somehow puts you at an economic disadvantage. What it doesn't prove is that you can tax yourself to prosperity. We're not making that case. We are making the case that the public sector in any given state has to raise adequate revenue to fund core public services like infrastructure and education and healthcare and social services and public safety, et cetera, at the right levels to meet demand and generate desired outcomes. So you need your tax policy designed to do that. And if your tax policy is designed to do that, then you will be in a decent economic competitive situation, irrespective of the fact that you may have a higher tax here than that state does over there. And in fact, none of the data show a correlation between state tax policy and economic competitiveness. The correlations go to other things like, for instance, investment in public education and that kind of thing. So a little more data on that to show you how little Illinois' tax policy has helped it in an economic standpoint. So from at least, and we can't get data back earlier than this. This is why I'm only going back to 1980. So from 1980 to 2010, Illinois consistently ranked in the bottom 8 in the nation in total state and local tax burden as a percentage of income. And that data comes straight from the Federation of Tax Administrators. And all they do at that federation is literally take the consolidated audited financial reports of the different states and put them online. And so they look at all state and local revenue generated from any source, which includes taxes and fees, so property taxes, sales taxes, driver's license fees, hunting fees, literally everything charged by state or local government, takes all that revenue collected and divides it by the personal income in the state to get a percentage burden, and it compares them. So there's no secret modeling, there's no assumptions. It's very simple math, it's publicly available data, and it's unassailable. It's based on the audited financial reports of the states. Bottom line is Illinois has been consistently very low tax over the last four decades. Despite that, our economic growth since 1980 has lagged both the Midwest and the rest of the nation, which overall were higher tax than Illinois. Why didn't being lower tax buy us this huge economic competitiveness? And the truth is because our lower tax system actually starved the state of adequate revenue, creating this structural deficit problem that then encouraged the state to engage in really poor fiscal practices like borrowing against the pensions to fund services, which created a very unstable future outlook and really hindered Illinois' capacity to invest in things that we know the private sector likes, like infrastructure and education.
We're talking with Ralph Martire of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability on Focus. And we will be back with more conversation about the state budget and how to fix it after this break. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Ralph Martire of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. He'll be speaking Thursday night at 7 at the Champaign Public Library as the guest of the Champaign County League of Women Voters. We're talking about ways to balance the state budget. You can call in and talk to Ralph as well at 333-9455. Or toll-free 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Let's take a caller now on line one. Paul in Champaign County, you're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. One thing I wanted to point out is American for Prosperity is basically Koch Brothers funded to at least the seed money, and you're very right in characterizing their the sort of free market fundamentalist, which somehow conveniently serves their interests so well. But I remember when you were around, and I think you were on Focus then too, perhaps, maybe not, but at the YMCA here on campus, you were talking about, and this was at the time when the last incremental tax increase went ahead in Illinois, how dire that was supposed to, the consequences were going to be and all. But I remember you saying that you couldn't get an op-ed in the paper declaiming a lot of the propaganda, the commonplaces about how, Illinois' taxes were high. It was a mantra. And it wasn't even true, and you just had a statistic there, but maybe you could break it out. And I think Indiana has actually changed their income tax, if I recall. But we were behind, if I recall, both Missouri and Indiana, but it was pretty comparable, actually, mainly. And so what I'm getting at is this constant mantra that Illinois is a high tax state is just rubbish, and services are awful compared to other states that even have less industrial wealth and other kinds of wealth it's scandalous, and I just wanted you to sort of, are you getting a better access and getting your point of view out better this time? Because, I mean, to some people, I'm sure there's some people pulling their hair and saying, what planet does this guy live on? Because they hear constant drumbeat is always to the contrary. So I think I'll have to hang up and listen on the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the media outlets, in particular, you look at like the Chicago Tribune, et cetera, are owned by large corporate interests that have taken an ideological sort of line in the sand on where they stand on things like tax policy. And so they're not very receptive to printing in their editorial pages stuff that's contrary to what they believe is the right approach. I'm not saying that they're evil people for this, right? They have a worldview, and they just want to reinforce their worldview. But it's not really the best way to inform the public. And you're exactly right. So at the time, what we were talking about were the governors of Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Indiana had all come into Illinois. This was right after the temporary increase of our corporate income tax rate from 4.8% up to 7%, saying now that, you know, you're raising your corporate taxes, all your businesses are going to flee to our state. And what I kept trying to point out at that time, and none of the major media outlets would carry, was that each of Wisconsin, Indiana, and New Jersey already have corporate income tax rates that are greater than 7%. And in fact, the lowest of them, I think, was 7.2%. New Jersey went up to 9%. Not one of the media outlets called these governors on that fact, that the existing corporate income tax rates in each of Wisconsin, Indiana, and New Jersey were significantly higher already than our new rate was, which I just found disingenuous and really counterproductive to stimulating a public dialogue. And interestingly enough, we still remain one of the lower taxing states in the Midwest. Now, I'll give you some more data on that and the interplay between tax policy and public sector spending and the private sector and job creation, because I think that that's something that really is very poorly understood, and I appreciate you bringing this topic up. So the first full year of recovery following the Great Recession was calendar year 2010. The Great Recession ended in June of 2009. So 2010 is the first year of recovery. And in 2010, we had not in Illinois yet passed our temporary tax increase. So we were still about 43rd, 44th in the nation in total state and local tax burden. There aren't consolidated audited financial reports for all states since that juncture. Our rough estimate is that we've gone up to 40th, maybe 39th in the nation, still very low after the temporary tax increase, but obviously it was a tax increase, so we did go up. But in 2010, pre-temporary tax increase, Illinois and Missouri were the two lowest taxing states in the entire Midwest. They also performed the worst in growing their state GDP on a percentage basis in the first full year of recovery following the Great Recession. They were the bottom two states. Now, why would that be? And the answer, interestingly enough, comes from a Republican economist who works for a bond rating agency. The gentleman's name is Mark Zandi, and he works for Moody's.com, and he's their top fiscal analyst, I say he's a Republican economist because when Republican Senator John McCain ran for the presidency against Obama the first time around, Zandi was the principal economic advisor in McCain's campaign. So here you have a moderate to conservative Republican economist, PhD guy, who works at a bond rating agency. Zandi analyzed the impact of different fiscal actions state governments can take in response to a recession. They could either raise taxes the way the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, for instance, my organization suggests, which is by focusing the tax increase on more affluent people who are paying taxes out of their growing wealth, and then maintaining your spending, or cutting your spending, which is what Illinois has chosen to do, to mostly resolve a lot of its budget problems. And what he found was that for every dollar state government cut in spending, the private sector would lose about $1.31 of economic activity as a negative multiplier of this spending cut as it shifted through the economy. And that would create significant job loss. Indeed, in a state the size of Illinois and with our budget deficit, which has been hovering around, like I said, $9 billion the last few years, so let's call it $9 billion, if we were to try to cut $9 billion in spending from our general fund, according to Mark Zandi's analysis, that would cause our private sector to lose 121,000 jobs. Why? Well, what is the private sector economy? It's consumer spending. It's people like you and me buying junk and such. Well, what does state government spend its money on? 80 to 85% of all expenditures done at the state level are the wages or salaries of the teachers or the correctional officers or the social workers or the healthcare workers that actually provide the services. So when state government cuts spending, what it's really cutting is wages. And those wages then aren't available to be spent in the private sector economy on consumer spending. Since consumer spending is anywhere from 68 to 70% of all economic activity at both the state and federal levels, that has a huge negative multiplier effect. Now go back to the fact that Missouri and Illinois, the two lowest taxing states in the entire Midwest, did the worst job growing their economies in the first full year of recovery coming out of the Great Recession, and Illinois' poor performance can't be blamed on the temporary tax increase because it hadn't happened yet. Bottom line, because Illinois and Missouri had such low tax policy, they couldn't weather the impact of the recession as well as their higher tax neighbors. So they had to implement greater cuts in spending, which meant greater reductions in wages to teachers and correctional officers, et cetera, which then meant greater reduction in consumer spending, which meant diminished private sector activity. when you lay all the data together, it's very clear and very logical how this all works together. And it should be pointed out, while a number of folks take shots at our organization because we've suggested that tax reform has to happen if we're going to really fix our state's fiscal house and move forward economically, that our group is not truly nonpartisan. We are bipartisan, and our board of directors includes very prominent Republicans and Democrats. In fact, my board includes a gentleman by the name of Stephen Schnorf, who is the director of the Bureau of the Budget under Governors Edgar and Ryan, and it includes former Republican State Representative Bill O'Connor, who is a pretty conservative Republican. In fact, he's our board chair. He even used to be Tom Cross's chief of staff for a while, the minority leader. So we don't let ideology impact our recommendations at the center. It sort of makes us unique. We are not driven by that. We're driven by data and best practices.
Now, Ralph, when I look at the organization's funders for the Centers for Tax and Budget Accountability, I do see an awful lot of union organizations and an awful lot of organizations representing state employees and others who would fall under the state pension system.
And they don't even support our pension proposal. So here's the thing. We get financial support from unions. We get it from foundations. We get it from businesses. We get it from individuals.
Which businesses?
LaSalle Bank was a funder for years. There's a number of small businesses that make donations to us. We get support from a ton of individuals, including people at Mesereau Financial, et cetera, and foundations like the MacArthur Foundation.
But larger groups, Illinois Manufacturers Association, State Chamber of Commerce, they certainly have not come online with your point of view.
They have at times, and they haven't at times. I mean, we've worked with them on some things and not with them on other things. I mean, so the bottom line is I can't control what other organizations are and aren't willing to support. We can only do what we do. We have a bipartisan board. Our work is staff-driven. It is evidence-based. It's peer-reviewed. No other organization sends their work out for independent peer review, and our independent peer reviewers include people identified as both Republican and Democratic PhD economists that teach tax and fiscal policy for the University of Illinois. Heck, it even includes the head of state and local tax for the General Accounting Office in D.C., a PhD economist out there. No other organization sends their work out for peer review. Our stuff is all data-based and best practice-based. And if you're going to fund us, and the unions get this, and they write us checks because 7 out of 10 times they like what we say, 3 out of 10 times they hold their nose hearing what we have to say, and then I get yelled at by them. But the deal is if you cut us a check to fund us, you're funding our work, but you have no say in our conclusions. That is a very different deal than what the more ideologically based think tanks do. And quite frankly, it's a different approach. And we've had our funding cut in some years by unions who didn't like positions we've taken. And I'll tell you one thing we have done, and you can go back to the records and find it, that no other organization can claim. We have taken public stances in testimony that are 180 degrees from the union stances, all public employee union stances, on everything from tax policy to pension policy. Yet they still fund us. They still fund us because they get the value of what we do. They absolutely don't dictate what we say or the positions we take. And, in fact, find a time. Illinois Policy Institute testified against the interest of big business or corporate America. Find a time. The Manufacturers Association or the Chamber of Commerce took a position against their funders. Just once, and you won't.
Ralph,
and that is what makes us unique.
Ralph, we have the phone banks full of people waiting to talk to you. Let's start with line four, Tom and Sullivan. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, I have two questions. I have nothing against retirements or whatever, but I'm self-employed, and I have to fund my own through a Roth IRA or through a Roth plan or a 401k. Why? I'd rather pay the teachers another dollar an hour, and they have to fund their own savings and whatever because there's nobody funding mine. The other thing is, and I've called before, Chicago Board of Trade or Chicago Mercantile, you ought to charge a $5 transaction fee on every trade because if I go to New York or American Stock Exchange and I buy 100 shares, 200 shares, whatever, there's a $5 transaction fee. It has been that for many years. They tried to increase it to $7.50, and they rolled it back to $5. It has been there, and every brokerage house I deal with charges a $5 transaction fee. So why doesn't the state do that? Because there is so many transactions at the Board of Trade and Mercantile, it would help you out tremendously.
Yeah, the transaction fee charged in New York, I mean, that's a really good point. The transaction fee charged in New York is actually refunded. And so hopefully you will see a countervailing refund of that somewhere in your paperwork.
I have never seen a refund, period.
So that's a scary thing, because I know that the state has had that as policy, but they actually only collected that fee, that transaction tax, for about a year or two, and then they started refunding it. So interesting thing.
Totally incorrect.
No, you can look it up. So the New York transaction fee is reimbursed. But bigger picture, I didn't quite hear what you said on the teachers. I'm sorry, my phone connection didn't. If you could repeat that, because I thought it was interesting and I wanted to respond to it.
If instead of having a retirement fund for them paid by the state, if a teacher made $30 an hour, I'd rather pay him $31 an hour or $32, whatever the case may be. But they would have to fund their own Roth, Keyhole, or IRA, you know, for perpetuity, you know, the longevity, because there's no one out here in my business that's funding my 401k, Roth, or whatever. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of issues that you raise with that, and that's a very cogent thought, and it's one that is both sophisticated and frankly shared at some level or number by a lot of people. So I do want to respond to it on a number of different levels. And number one is, believe it or not, the teachers do contribute significantly to their own retirement. They're actually taking well over 9.6% of their current wage that they contribute in to their retirement benefit. And so if you were to look at a typical 401k plan with a match and Social Security in the private sector, that would actually be 9.2%. So roughly, it's they're contributing more than your typical private sector worker does that has both those things. The fall down at the state level hasn't been what the employees have contributed in, which is actually relatively high, and it's going up now. But what the state has not contributed in, even though it should have. And in fact, the benefits that are sort of earned under our current retirement systems aren't what's created the problem, which is one of the misconceptions out there. And a 401k plan at the public sector level is significantly more expensive than a defined benefit plan unless you don't fund your defined benefit plan and you create a bunch of back due interest, et cetera, which is what Illinois has done. So let me get into that a little bit. So because the state didn't make its employer normal cost contribution, it created this huge unfunded liability that is really what's straining fiscal resources now. Benefits didn't do that. In fact, if you were to isolate out, and this is straight out of the Commission on Government Accountability, Forecasting and Accountability, COGFA, if you were to take their numbers, so this is the state of Illinois' own numbers, and isolate out the factors that have contributed to our unfunded liability today that are due to the pension systems as opposed to those that are due to the state's irresponsible borrowing for decades to paper over the structural imbalance I've been talking about, what you would quickly find is if the only problems were those problems inherent to the pension systems themselves, so benefit levels being increased over time, salaries being increased over time, changes in assumptions, changes in discount rates, people living longer than maybe we really want them to, all that stuff, if those were our only problems, we'd be over 80% funded today, which is healthy for a public system. There'd be no crisis, and our total pension contribution would only be $1.6 billion into the systems. Our pension contribution today is over $6 billion. The rest of that is all debt service from this borrowing that's gone on for decades. And the borrowing wasn't just irresponsible when we incurred it, but the repayment plan that the state put in for intentionally for political reasons was ridiculously backloaded so that the vast majority of payments are happening now in out years. and that they're escalating by over $1 billion a year, which is just unattainable, unaffordable, and frankly, you can't design tax policy to jump in billion-dollar increments every year to meet this silly repayment plan. And that's what's killing the state. But it's not part of the public discussion. And so none of these proposals that have been put on the table that are designed to cut the benefits of workers will actually solve the problem. They'll save the state money. Obviously, if you cut benefits, you have less to pay. And paying less takes at least some of the burden off the state, so you get some savings. But it doesn't take the real burden off the state, which is this rapidly, annually escalating pension payment. And let me give you a couple of fiscal years in a row so you have some numbers to put to that, and you could really see how the debt service is what's driving the problem. In fiscal year 2012, our total pension payment was just about $4 billion, 4.001. In fiscal year 2013, the year we're living in, it jumped to $5.1 billion. And in fiscal year 2014, next year, it's projected to go to about $6.4 billion. But the normal cost, the actual charge to the state of funding the benefits to workers, earned by workers, is only $1.6 billion each of those 3 years. It doesn't change. It's a flat amount. So what's really going up every year, and what is more than half of that payment, is this debt service, and it's jumping by over $1 billion a year. That's simply not a feasible repayment plan. So what we have suggested all along is whatever accommodation is reached on reductions in benefits, and frankly, it's hard for me to imagine any benefit cut that would be constitutional under Illinois law, because Illinois is one of three or four states in the nation that happens to have some of the strongest pension benefit guarantees in its constitution. So there literally can be no diminishment of a benefit that a worker gets from what they signed on to when they became a public sector worker. And so that's a real strong guarantee. It's been interpreted by our state Supreme Court. So it's unlikely that a lot of these benefit cuts are even constitutional. But even if they were, and even if they save the money that they think they're going to save, it still isn't going to take the pressure off from this debt service. So part of whatever happens, if you really want to resolve the fiscal crisis being created by the pension system, is a reamortization of the debt, much like a business would reamortize its debt if it had found it had a payment structure that it couldn't make. I mean, the bank would much prefer to reamortize your debt to the business rather than put you out of business and try to foreclose on your assets. Before I took this job running a bipartisan think tank, believe it or not, I was a corporate attorney doing mergers and acquisitions, structured finance, and intellectual property. And in fact, banks were a big part of my client base, and I did a lot of secured lending and sophisticated commercial transactions. And I could just tell you, banks loathe foreclosures. You never get even close to, you're lucky if you get 30 cents on the dollar in a foreclosure situation. You're much better to rework the debt. Well, Ralph, Illinois at this juncture needs to rework its debt.
Ralph, and I'm sorry, Tom, thank you for your call. I want to, with a couple of minutes left, I want to get at least one more call in to get a question over to Ralph Martire. This is on line one, Walter in Champaign. You're on the air on Focus.
Thank you. This is just a quick question. I am a retiree, and I don't pay state taxes. And I was surprised to find out that a friend of mine who's a former lobbyist for Standard Oil has a private pension, and he also doesn't pay state taxes. And I'm just wondering, I agree with the progressive idea of the tax increase, but what would that do? I know it wouldn't alleviate the whole debt, but what would it do to help the alleviate the situation? And would it be a good idea? Is it constitutional and the like?
Ralph, about 1 minute.
Yeah, okay. Well, it truly is constitutional. And of the 41 states with an income tax, Illinois is one of only three that excludes all retirement income. Even the federal government taxes retirement income once you're earning it. So if we were to include retirement income over $50,000, let's say we didn't want to be overtaxing low-income seniors that truly have a fixed income, even setting that cutoff at so $50,000 of your retirement income would be exempt, we'd only start taxing it, your $50,001, and just $1 gets taxed, that would raise over $900 million for the state of Illinois, and that's a pretty significant amount of revenue, and it certainly is something that needs to be discussed as part of the overall solution.
Well, thank you very much, Walter, for your call, and we are just about out of time here on Focus, and still a lot more to talk about, I think. So people may want to go see you this Thursday at the Champaign Public Library, when you'll be talking as the guest of the Champaign County League of Women Voters. Our guest has been Ralph Matiere of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Ralph, thank you for joining us on Focus. By the way, on our website, we've put a link over at will.illinois.edu/focus to the Illinois Budget Calculator that your organization has helped put together so that everybody can play this game of trying to balance the Illinois budget.
Yeah, we think that's a great tool because it'll let people know exactly how the state spends its money and how difficult it is to solve problems through the spending side. So I think it's a really valuable tool, and thank you so much for that plug.
Okay, that's in. We have that through Crane's Chicago Business, which worked with you. There is a registration wall, but no cost to get over to the Illinois Budget Calculator. Today's edition of Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. If you have any additional thoughts about today's program, go to will.illinois.edu/focus and let us know what your comment or question is. Tomorrow on Focus, I think all of us would welcome more money in their lives, but does that money have to be cash? We'll be talking about the potentials and potential drawbacks of a cashless society with David Wolman, author of The End of Money, and U of I finance professor Charles Kahn. That's on tomorrow's Focus here on WILL.